Going forward, this makes foreign companies hesitant to buy from the U.S.
Chinese apps in U.S. tech crosshairs. It's Tuesday, September 22nd. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, a Chinese firm collects massive personal data. Special teaching for special needs. Keeping presidential debates on track. Big money calls for big taxes. And singing to help heal COVID. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The battle between China and the United States over the fate of video sharing app TikTok appears to raise questions for the tech industry worldwide. What might the struggle over TikTok portend for global companies? Michelle Quinn has more.
For months, the world has watched as China and the United States have struggled over the fate of the popular TikTok app. Meanwhile, the U.S. continues to restrict Huawei, the Chinese telecommunications giant. Just this month, the U.S. issued new rules making it harder for Huawei to buy computer chips from other firms. Around the world, businesses are watching the battle the U.S. and China are waging in an array of communications industries and wondering what it will mean for them, according to Rob Atkinson, president of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. He also serves on TikTok's Content Advisory Council and argues that punitive measures imposed by Washington may ultimately force companies in the rest of the world to choose between two huge markets.
Going forward, this makes foreign companies hesitant to buy from the U.S. The risk of that to me is so big.
For decades, the United States has accused China of limiting access to its domestic market. Now the U.S. is ousting some Chinese companies from its marketplace, a shift many find surprising, said Heather Evans, director of Frontier Technology Research at the Asia Society of Northern California.
That type of control or sort of nationalism has definitely been something that America seemed to be the polar opposite of. This might be the beginning of a much stricter data regime and even more barriers for international companies that try to operate and win in the American economy.
In addition to limiting Chinese companies' reach and influence, U.S. policymakers could pursue another approach. Invest more in research and development to make sure the U.S. retains its edge in technology, said Andrew Grotto, director of the Geopolitics, Technology, and Governance Program at Stanford University.
You know, in a horse race, you can either outrun the competition or you can kneecap the horse before the race. And so they can't even get. And I think right now, you know, that's our strategy where we don't have, I think, a clear vision for how do we get our own horses in the race to be able to really compete. What is an appropriate role for the government to take, whether that's in regulatory policy, whether that's in promoting research, innovation, you know, as we look ahead to the future.
China's ascendancy as a technological powerhouse is sure to continue, likely putting it and the United States on a continued collision course over key industries. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, Oakland, California.
These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Increased China warplane activity unnerves Taiwan. Relatives of 12 Hong Kong people arrested by China demand access for own lawyers. Hong Kong shares slump as banks reel from illicit fund movement reports. Slow reopening for India's Taj Mahal after 6 months of COVID shutdown. Australia vows to protect Aboriginal heritage after destruction of sacred sites. You'll find expanded coverage of all these stories and much more when you visit Facebook at VOA Asia and stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. A Chinese firm with suspected ties to the Chinese government has been reportedly amassing a database of detailed personal information on 2.4 million people, including about 52,000 Americans, 35,000 Australians, and nearly 10,000 British citizens. Christopher Balding, former professor at HSBC Business School of Peking University Graduate School in Shenzhen, China, says the database was leaked to him last year, and he speaks with VOA's Adriana Zhang to tell us more about what he's uncovered.
It appears to be compiled from numerous sources. Some of it is technically relatively rudimentary in that it is crawled from sources like it has a lot of information from places like Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn. But there's also things that are distinctly more technically complex. For instance, there's an engine in there where it takes blog posts or reports from think tanks and it actually reads them and then turns out a summary in Chinese of, say, 1 to 3 paragraphs for somebody, an analyst, to read. So there's actually a lot of information in there. I think what is noticeable is that there appears to be classifiers or classes of individuals that it is targeting. For instance, politicians, family members of politicians, technology, academia, think tanks are some of the key institutions and individuals that they're targeting. And then I think finally, one of the things that stood out to me is there seems to be significant amounts of organized crime figures in this database. So we thought that was an interesting classification of individual to include in this database.
What do you mean by crime figures?
Basically organized crime, whether it was from Mexico or Italy, places like that, Japan with the Yakuza. We thought it was just very notable that they would include a not insignificant number of organized crime figures in this database.
Are they stealing the data from a database? Are they hacking into any database, or they are just collecting what's already out there publicly?
To possibly answer your question, yes to basically everything that you've said. This data compiles data from multiple sources and puts it into one place. So for instance, there is something known as crawling, where they take data that you know, they read your posts on Twitter or Facebook or LinkedIn and put them into this data. They also take data, for instance, if you have a biography on a website that would say, talk about who you are. We estimate about 80% of the data is what we call open source. There's also data that appears to be hacked or stolen data that comes from other sources. Some sources we're not entirely sure where it comes from, but there absolutely is non-public sources in there as well.
How is this data used? And what's the damage it could cause, or it is causing?
It appears that they're using this data to target individuals or institutions for influence and or intelligence operations. So for instance, it was noticeable that it was targeting people from like tech and academia and relatives of governments, relatives of politicians, I should say. So it appears that these are individuals that they might be starting to draw up influence or intelligence operations that are in areas that they are known to target.
Are you concerned about this data being used?
I would say I am concerned about this data being used because there do appear to have been legal breaches and even the very basic data. So it clearly speaks to the lengths that Chinese companies will go to and then how they intend to use this data. I think should be concerning to citizens and targeted individuals, individuals of influence in countries around the world.
Christopher Balding, former professor at HSBC Business School of Peking University Graduate School in Shenzhen, China, speaking with VOA's Adriana Zhang. Happening now in Asia, China's Air Force has released a video showing nuclear-capable H-6 bombers carrying out a simulated attack on what appears to be Anderson Air Force Base on the U.S. Pacific island of Guam as regional tensions rise. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. It's always great to have you with us on VOA Asia. Thanks for joining us today. While many schools are opening and virtually, the closure of schools due to the coronavirus pandemic has been a test for children with mental and physical disabilities and their families all over the world. The daily routine has changed dramatically, and it affects their learning process and puts pressure on parents. VOA's Salman Khan has filed this report on how parents and children are adapting in Lahore, Pakistan.
16-year-old Alishba, who has Down syndrome, had a normal daily routine before the coronavirus pandemic. She would wake up early in the morning and get ready for school. But since the closure of schools, she is now studying online. Alishba's mother says she now has to be by her side at all times.
When she has her online classes, I have to sit with her, which means I run late in my work chores at home.
The Child Welfare Center at Punjab University trains children with special needs between the ages of 5 and 16, with classes including physiotherapy, speech therapy, music, and sports. The program at the university has been closed due to the coronavirus pandemic and is now only offering online classes. The program's principal admits that it is difficult for parents to tackle these responsibilities on their own.
Teachers are skilled in this profession. Music teachers try to teach kids online who have access to internet. Our sports teachers are also trying to teach basketball, dribbling, and yoga so kids don't get bored studying all day.
For Abdul Hadi, the transition from in-person classes to online classes has been challenging. But Hadi's father says playing video games helps him stay calm.
Before, he used to go to the park, go out, but now everything has stopped. He loves to play Ludo game. He gets everyone to play with him.
Some parents are having to learn technology they didn't know so they can help their children.
It's difficult, not just for my son, but for me as well. Sometimes I have to run to his aunts and uncles if I have technical issues, like the camera not working on something else.
One, shabash.
Abida Zahid, who is a teacher at the Child Welfare Center, says special needs children require one-on-one sessions because each child has a different learning curve.
Having a class session with one child, you lose track of time because it takes time for you to set a special child's mood to learning. And it's a whole family effort to get them in that mindset.
One, two pencils.
Punjab University's Child Welfare Center is also providing online educational videos for parents so that they could better understand their children's needs and help come up with new ways of keeping them busy and educating them at the same time. COVID cases in Pakistan are dropping, so the government is considering opening schools in the near future. That's good news for parents who are working, teaching, and parenting all at the same time. For Salman Khan in Lahore, Pakistan, Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see with links to find them easily. With VOA Asia, you can also follow radio program host VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia. In the forests and on the remote offshore islands of Taiwan, a group of conservationists say they are racing against time to collect as many rare plant species as they can before they're lost to climate change and human encroachment. You can see more on VOA 60 and find all the big stories throughout the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, the next big date on the U.S. presidential political calendar is right around the corner, Tuesday, September 29th, when the first of three debates will be held between President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden. But there will be a third person on stage that night. It's the moderator. VOA's Steve Reddish examines how that person impacts the course of the debate.
While the spotlight is on what the candidates say during the debate, there is a third person on the stage who has a lot to say about what is said and when. The debate moderator does more than just ask questions.
Yeah, I think moderators should ask important questions, But I think the most important job of the moderator is the follow-up, right? When they give an answer or there's a debate occurring, right, to know the appropriate questions to ask in the follow-up.
Prominent journalists are selected debate moderators by the Nonpartisan Commission on Presidential Debates. Jim Lehrer, the late news anchor from the Public Broadcasting Service, moderated the most presidential debates, 12.
If somebody says, I've got a 7-point plan for that, he would say, well, give me your first 3 points.
Mary Kate Carey of the University of Virginia's Miller Center attended a workshop about moderating debates hosted by Lehrer.
He says, if you ask a long and complicated question, you will get a long and complicated answer. And so he liked things that said, for example, what's a good deal look like to you? Or do you agree with that? And things like that.
Carey says Lehrer met with the candidates before the debate to explain how he would enforce the rules. He also made a point of explaining the rules to the audience to get their buy-in.
And if candidate A started violating the rules and talking too long or not letting other people speak or hamming it up and, taking the stage too much, the audience would start to turn on the person because they knew the rules. And that would make it much easier for the moderator to say, excuse me, that's a violation of the rules. Let's now do X, Y, and Z.
And if a candidate says something untrue?
He does not consider it the moderator's job to suddenly jump in and be a fact checker. He thought the moderator should pause and say, I'd like to give you an opportunity to clarify what you just said.
In 2012, there was a huge controversy with Candy Crowley. She fact checked Romney during the debate.
I want to make sure we get that for the record, because it took the president 14 days before he called the attack in Benghazi an act of terror.
Get the transcript.
He did, in fact, sir. So let me call it an act of terror.
Can you say that a little louder, Candy?
It had sort of been a tense back and forth between the two candidates, and she intervened to try to sort of move along the conversation. And, there was a huge outcry on the right for her doing that.
The 2020 debate moderators have been selected. Chris Wallace of Fox News drew the first presidential debate on September 29th. Wallace was a debate moderator in 2016. Steve Scully, senior executive producer and host for the cable public service channel C-SPAN, moderates the second presidential debate, which will be a town hall format. Debate 3 will be moderated by Kristen Welker, who covers the White House for NBC News. The only debate between the vice presidential candidates will be moderated by Susan Page, Washington bureau chief for USA Today. Mary Kate Carey recalls the best advice 12-time moderator Jim Lehrer imparted: avoid being the story.
The quote that I always think is, if anybody is quoting me, the moderator, afterwards I have failed.
Steve Reddish, VOA News, Washington.
Coronavirus questions. Can the virus be spread by mosquito bites? Is there a vaccine or medication that prevents it? Is there any medicine that cures it? The answer to all of the questions is no. The best steps to take: wash your hands, cover your cough, stay at home if you are sick or advised to by local authorities.
Now on VOA Asia, dozens of millionaires from around the world have signed a collective letter urging their respective governments to raise taxes. But not everyone agrees that the move is a good idea. Daria Degutz has the story.
More than 80 millionaires from the U.S. and 6 other countries are urging their governments to raise taxes. Among the signees are Walt Disney Company heiress Abigail Disney, former BlackRock, Inc. managing director Maurice Pearl, and Danish-Iranian entrepreneur Jafar Shalchi. Those who signed the letter say the coronavirus pandemic can last for years and charity donations alone won't combat the impact.
I think that rich people have to understand that the system is just unsustainable the way it is. We've seen all these protests. We've seen millions of people who are unemployed due to the COVID crisis. And we've seen the wealthy among us, investors like me, becoming more and more and more wealthy. And we're getting to a point where there's going to be a few rich people and lots of poor people. And that's not, that doesn't work.
America ranks first in the number of millionaires. According to Forbes, over 18.5 million Americans have over $1 million in their bank accounts. And a lot of experts believe the rich are not taxed appropriately. They say a 3% tax increase on the ultra-rich could raise over $1 billion in about a decade.
The much more important thing is to do this permanently, because the things that led to COVID-19 being so hard in the United States are long-standing problems that we've had in our society because of underinvestment, because of lack of investment in lower-income neighborhoods.
But some Americans do not believe further taxing the rich is the answer, and Republicans have traditionally opposed the move. And some experts suggest there are many other ways the rich can help besides paying more taxes.
There's a process at the U.S. Treasury Department, at least for the American taxpayers of that group, that they can actually just contribute directly to the United States Treasury. So if they're waiting for Washington, in this case the United States, to act, they don't have to do that.
Experts add that in 2021, the U.S. will face a record budget deficit, which in turn will lead to more calls to raise taxes on the rich. Daria D. Goods for VOA News, Washington.
Doctors around the United States are continuing to work around the clock to save lives of tens of thousands of patients who've been infected with COVID-19. Overworked and constantly at risk because of their lack of protective equipment, they nevertheless keep going. At the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, one doctor is trying to raise the spirits of his coworkers and of those of the patients they're treating. Anna Nelson has the story. It's narrated by Anna Rice.
Dr. Elvis Francois has found a way to bring hope and inspiration. An orthopedic surgery resident at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, Francois also happens to be a great singer.
There are pianos all across the campus at Mayo Clinic. And so we would sometimes we'll just sit down and just play music. A lot of times there are a lot of patients who are walking by and we'll play music for people. But unfortunately, with COVID-19, where there weren't patients around, but that was at the hospital where we finished up a work shift and we were able to share music that way.
Francois is finishing his five-year residency and has been sharing his videos on social media for the past 2 years. But none has moved people more than his rendition of John Lennon's song Imagine.
This is the first time in a generation that we could all remember that the entire world is facing this one problem. And with this global pandemic, you know, it's a pause. It's almost like hitting the pause button, because before this, you know, so much of the world is divided. They're by country, divided by politics, and divided by race, divided by a number of things. And this is an opportunity and a reminder for us to realize that we are one people. This is, we're in this together.
Although the Mayo Clinic has not yet seen a surge of coronavirus patients like in other places in the U.S., Francois says that the clinic is ready for an all-hands-on-deck situation, and so is he.
So you realize that you can only help someone with surgery so much, you can only do so much with medication. You know, for me, I realized that music goes places that medicine can't go. Yes, medicine can heal the body, but music heals the soul. And I'm just privileged and honored to be in a position where I could help people with both music and both medicine. And that's why those two things mean so much to me.
Francois adds he's getting messages from doctors and nurses around the world, thanking him for giving them hope and taking their mind off the sometimes tragic things they see at work every day.
You might say that I'm a dreamer.
For Anna Nelson in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
I hope someday that you will join us.
That's our program for today. We thank you for joining us on VOA Asia. You can continue by following us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube, all at VOA Asia. We also thank those who help bring this program to you each and every day, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, and Keith Lane. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead. Be safe. Be well.